Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast and Radio MD iHeart, or wherever you download us from. 50,000 a week of you can't be wrong. Thank you for doing it. This is 1188B. The B's are always great guests. The A's, the latest medical news of the week and what it means to you. And we have some medical news this week that'll pertain to our author, Elizabeth Comen, C-O-M-E-N. She has written an absolutely sensational book, All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. And I can tell you, I literally, and maybe it's because I'm a doctor, but I don't think so, I literally couldn't put this book down. So thank you, Elizabeth, for writing it. And we'll talk to you in just a second. I want to remind our listeners, go to longevityplaybook.com, sign up for the free newsletter, or go to lifefirstnaturals.com. Those are our two sponsors, lifefirstnaturals.com, the makers of TruBiotics and Bovine Colostrum. You can go to their website. Bovine Colostrum has been advertising with us for about 5 years, way before Colostrum became popular. That's because they had done the randomized controlled studies that showed the benefit in preventing bloating, in preventing leaky gut after exercise, in preventing upper respiratory infections. Believe it or not, they used Italian soccer players in that randomized controlled trial. But go to their website. You can find the randomized controlled trials on their site. That's lifesfirstnaturals.com. Now let's talk to Elizabeth Comen. She is a breast cancer specialist, and I may be wrong, you may be an oncologist in general, Elizabeth, so I apologize if I'm categorizing you wrong. She graduated from Harvard College and Harvard Medical School, and then did her residency in internal medicine and her fellowship. Her internal medicine was at Mount Sinai, and her fellowship was at Memorial Sloan Kettering. This is a sensational book. And in fact, it opened my eyes as I was talking to patients last week. I have an awful lot of husband and wife combinations. I practice preventive medicine. And what I noticed was exactly what Elizabeth says. When she talks to patients, one of the things the women do at the end is they say, am I going to die? Why did this happen to me? And I'm so sorry for sweating. That is, they apologize for what has happened to them. Men never do. And I noticed that was happening with my own patients. And so, Elizabeth, you have opened my eyes. When did you notice that?
So first of all, thank you so much for having me and for the praise. It really means so much to know that there is a groundswell of people that are just recognizing there's so much more to be done for women's health. In terms of when did I first start noticing the apologizing, you know, it's interesting. I've been a breast oncologist, and you got it right. I'm trained in general oncology, but then specialized in breast cancer. And I've been taking care of, you know, thousands of breast cancer patients over the years. But I don't think I noticed it, probably because I was doing it myself all the time as a patient, as a woman in the world. And it was really in the last few years, there was one instance where I had a medical student with me. And you know, when you have a med student, you're always a little bit more accountable and kind of noticing everything in the room and you want to do a good job. And there was a particular woman who, as I was examining her, just profusely started apologizing because she was sweating. And you know, when you do a breast exam, you have to have your arms up over your head. And she was anxious because she had just been diagnosed with cancer. And I thought to myself, how many women have already apologized to me in this one day for the exact same thing? And I started to take note. And then it was kind of a tsunami in front of me that I just didn't realize about how much women apologize for basic human functions, let alone being sick, which happens all the time, as you know.
And in that first, I think it's the introduction, I noticed another thing that you wrote that I do all the time, which is I've been doing it for literally 50 years now, which is I ask patients what brings them joy. Why do they like living? But I do it to get patients motivated. And I noticed another reason you said, what was that?
Well, there are so many reasons why I think that's important, but I think, and I'm thrilled that you ask patients that question, but in my practice, it's also because that's the way that we access what really matters to them and what really holds them back. And I think what we find a lot of times with female patients is that they're either feeling so much shame and blame about their body that it's hard to really access what they want from their lives, what brings them joy, what helps them thrive. And in my practice, certainly that becomes important for the types of treatments that we give, whether it's chemotherapy that could cause neuropathy or whether it's medications that cause decrease in sexual function or libido. A lot of the things that bring women joy, we haven't incorporated into how we care for them as physicians.
Now, as you might guess, this is a wonderful book. It is written by system, much like Dr. Oz and I did the owner's manual. But this includes what I would call a lot of the history of where we learned this. And it's wonderful history. So if you have any interest in history, this is a great, and literally could not put this book down. But I didn't get to the breast cancer area. And I wondered if you had included the story of how difficult it was, which the Cleveland Clinic led this, so I can say that. I did train at Harvard, so I did train at Beth Israel in Boston after going to UCSF. But at the Cleveland Clinic, one of the real advances in women's breast cancer treatment was the lumpectomy versus the radical mastectomy. And I don't know if you put in there how difficult that study was to do, but that is part of what you find in this book, which is how difficult it was for certain things to get done. So one of the interesting things is, I guess, the acceptance of appearance as an important component of health and a feeling of worth. Talk to us a little bit about that, because this is, it's a wonderful chapter you wrote on that.
Well, right. So the first chapter goes over the history of plastic surgery. And for all of medicine, as we know it today, in the more codified structure, this was a system built by men where women were the patients. And certainly in the field of plastic surgery, while that's changing historically, it was men operating on female patients. So the idea of the male gaze became very important. In my field in particular, what we know is that, and actually how I started off in breast cancer, was working, volunteering at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working with women on their look good, feel better aspect of breast cancer treatment. And what's really interesting about the history of plastic surgery and medicine and women is that there is a component to really empowering and feeling good in yourself and feeling good about how you look. And also, is there a part of it that can be punishing and oppressive from cultural standards? So I think what I really found fascinating in writing this book is, how do we get to a place where we acknowledge that for many women, how they look and how they look through their treatment, whether it's plastic surgery for their breast cancer or the choices they make for their body, or whether they keep their hair or don't, how we incorporate their sense of self and value that, whether it's whatever part of their body that may be important for them. In some women, it's important, in some women, it's not. But particularly when it comes to beauty and vanity, it's been a double-edged, complicated sword in the history of medicine.
And I'm going to skip on that double edge to the chapter on hormones. This was one that was really led by women, and I think came to the wrong answer. Meaning it came to the wrong answer because they, by trying to save money, that is, a drug company gave them Prempro for free, which saved NIH and the research costs a lot. It had them choose a poor choice of hormone therapy that has led to both a wrong and, I think, a misinterpretation of the data as well. And so that actually is one that men actually probably instigated by saying, this is going to be good. And then it proved, the study proved to be misinterpreted, even by, a lead female investigator, Joanne Manson.
Yeah. I mean, I think the key here is that a couple things. The book is really not about, you know, men versus women. There's good and men, male and female doctors across the board. But of course, the history of medicine was predominantly men. But with respect to hormone therapy, I think where we are today is we've ping-ponged women so many times back and forth that everybody should be on hormone replacement therapy. And oh my goodness, during my training, nobody could be on it because you're all going to get breast cancer. And we're finally coming to a place today where we realize that it's really about individual decision-making, discussion with your doctor about the risks and benefits. And we have so far to go. I mean, we don't know about whether we can effectively give testosterone to women safely. We don't know for breast cancer patients, for example, some of whom may have breast cancers that are not driven by estrogen, can we safely in the future give them some level of hormone replacement therapy? There's so many unanswered questions and ways that we've left women feeling quite confused and frankly suffering in the process because the science needs to do better.
I should say one of the stories that you probably don't know because it isn't well known is how women got to be 50% in medical school classes. Do you know that story?
Well, I think there's probably different versions of it. Why don't you tell yours?
In 1967, when I was a medical student in the freshman year at UC San Francisco, we started protesting the Vietnam War by marching on the steps of the medical science building at UCSF. UCSF at that time was only 4 years outside of being a Berkeley graduate school. And we had a new chancellor, literally knew the month that we started walking. And of course, you couldn't walk. So he ran out while we started protesting. We had just gotten our white coats. They were formaldehyde smelling white coats, but they were white coats. And he comes out and says, "You've got to stop, stop. Ronald Reagan shut down Berkeley. He'll shut us down. He'll even close this whole school. Come on in. I'll give you whatever you want." So literally 10 of us went into his office and he said, "What do you want? I'll give it to you." And of course, one of the students, and I'm blanking on his name, said, "Can we have overnight to think about it?" Since we didn't know what we wanted at all. But our advisors were at that time, a guy named Varmus, was the first...
Harold Varmus?
Yes. Varmus and Bishop were our first year advisors. Bishop was a second year faculty member, and Varmus was a graduate student, but the medical school in the freshman class had those assigned as our advisors. So we went to their house that evening. You know, the medical students in that era, we had classes from 8 to 5:30 with 45 minutes for lunch. And it was during that lunch hour we protested. So at about 7 o'clock or something, we gathered at, I can't remember, it was at Bishop's either lab or house. And one of the students said, "Look, women are just as good as we are. They're only 10% in our class." There were literally 14 out of 134. And he said, "Let's tell them we want 50% women in the class." And somehow we went down to the chancellor's office the next day. And he said, "Done." And if you look at the class of the entering class of 1973, which is the next one to be admitted, it was 50-50. He honored that. And that's how medical school classes became 50-50. And it was because Ronald Reagan really shut down Berkeley. And we had a new chancellor.
Well, it's a fabulous story. It's a fabulous story. I mean, I think you're part of a trailblazing class. And also, I mean, if you look at my med school class, which was over 50% women, I think the interesting question for me that I've thought about is the answer to diversifying and really healing our healthcare system necessarily parity in terms of who gets into med school about numbers, about 50% here of women versus men? I think it's also about how we have room for the different spirits and personalities that can occupy our healthcare system. So if, for example, we're all, as a woman, trying to necessarily fit into some male model of how I'm supposed to behave in the hospital necessarily, is that really diversifying our workforce? I think there's some aspects of, I call it feminine healing, whether that's in a male or a female, that have kind of been squeezed out of medicine, that maybe we could try to, the next phase would be to infuse that spirit back in, regardless of what sex you were born as.
Well, I think empathy is a key thing, and that's one of the things you bring up in the book on how much what I really think is women have more empathy. I'm going to give you one more story about women and men in that era. So my wife, who's also a physician and a pediatrician, developmental pediatrician, when she was on rotation at Mass General, the other medical students said, how can you be here? You're cutting a doctor out. You're not going to even work hard in medicine. And that was the feeling in that era, that women were, you know, that 10% was excluding men. But in fact, as you have demonstrated, there is a great benefit of having women, and I think hugely in leadership positions. One of the chapters in the book is on, if you will, bones as well. So talk to us a little bit about women's bones and what we should know about that.
Well, it sounds like you're a specialist in preventative health and longevity. So as you know, it's so important that women's bone health be protected over time. Also, our skeletons are different than male in terms of the anatomy and the angles. One of the things that I'm sure you may remember from medical school is when I learned about anatomy in our cadavers, in our anatomy class, everything was learned on a male model. And the only thing that we would see in terms of anatomical pictures was representations of women for reproductive function or breast function. And if you look at the data behind that, anatomical textbooks are skewed more towards the male form. And I think what gets lost in that is a lot of sports injuries, ACLs, for example, ACL tears are far more common in women among men. And we're still playing catch up of how to make sure we really safeguard women from these injuries and treat them appropriately, but also how we train women. I mean, I had very little nutrition and exercise guidance in medical school, but we know that especially for women, strength training, weight-bearing exercise is so important for our overall health and well-being, for prevention of falls, for prevention of fractures, for mobility. And I'm sure that's something that you focus on in your practice, but that's not where history has necessarily led us in terms of protecting women's bodies.
I really think that both genders need to have balance training and a learn to fall class repeatedly given after age 50. I want to tell you one more story that your book stimulated in me, which was the story of how the most watched, I don't know if you know, the most watched video of all videos on YouTube for medical professionals is the empathy one from the Cleveland Clinic. And I don't know how you, if you know how that started, but Toby Cosgrove, our CEO, was teaching a course. I was there for one lecture talking about the Cleveland Clinic model to the Harvard Business School, at which point one of the students, a woman in her sophomore year in the question answer period, got up and said, Dr. Cosgrove, do you teach empathy? I took my mother to the Mayo Clinic for her valve replacement because they're more empathetic than you are at the Cleveland Clinic. Do you teach empathy? And Toby Cosgrove at that point looked up the word empathy on Google. As he claims, he doesn't know what it meant. And all of us have a mandatory empathy training on that video, as well as it's been, I think it's got more than 3 million views now.
That's spectacular. Well, I just looked, it's one of them has 7 million views, which is spectacular. I have to take it over 7 million and be another person to watch it. I've not seen it, but I've had a long interest in the history of medicine. I mean, the history of empathy, rather. I remember in medical or in undergrad watching the movie about Patch Adams.
Yes.
I don't know if you recall that movie. That was such a wonderful idea about how you connect with the human spirit. But I think, you know, you said that women necessarily have more empathy. I don't know that we do, but I think that empathy can be nurtured in everybody. And I think that's one of the key things that I'm hoping in this book, that we can access that we can nurture it, that we can celebrate it, and that it doesn't have to fall across gendered lines, but that we can continue to honor that in medicine as well.
And they knock it out of us in the freshman year, at least they did in my era. The book is a sensational book. As you can tell, I could talk forever to Elizabeth Komen. The book is so good. It is all in her head. The Truth and Lies, Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. I'm going to tell you, if you read one book that I have talked about in the last year, and we've had a lot of great books on, but I actually think this is the book I like the best, and I hope you do too, All in Her Head, by Elizabeth Komen, written brilliantly. I got to tell you, it is a fun read. It is a fast read, and it is brilliantly integrates medicine, history, and just fun. Thank you for writing it. It is all in her head. Remember, our sponsors are Life's First Naturals, the makers of TruBiotics and Bovine Colostrum. You can go to their website, lifesfirstnaturals.com, and find out the randomized double-blind studies on why those are useful. And of course, longevityplaybook.com. Take the actual age test, sign up for the free newsletter. It gives you 250 words of the best in longevity every week. And come back here. Next week's guest is Paul Offit, though, who is a brilliant vaccine researcher and will talk to us about the benefits and hazards of vaccines. But this week, there is no better book than All in Her Head that I've read in probably the last 10 years. Thanks again, Elizabeth.